Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Seth Diamond, Executive Deputy Commissioner of New York City's Family Independence Administration. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Stu Advansky. Seth, would you tell us more about the Temporary Cash Assistance Program? Specifically, how does it work? What's the eligibility? And what have been the effects in the recent economic downturn on the program?
Well, cash assistance is the name we use in New York City to refer to what's more commonly called welfare. And it's the program that's available for people at very low income levels who have – most people have no income, although there are some people who have low-wage jobs. And it's – in New York, sort of unusually compared to most of the rest of the country, it's available both to single parents or married couples with children and single individuals with no children. Most places in the country have moved away from service to able-bodied single individuals, but New York has not done that. So we have – we continue to have a program that has sort of two basic components. One is a family program that serves people with children. Most of the people in that program are single parents, although there are some married couples. And then a second program that serves single childless individuals. The single childless program is funded by New York City and New York State, splitting the cost. The program for families has a federal share also. The federal government pays about half the cost, and the city and state split the remaining costs.
And the recent economic downturn that we're experiencing, has the program changed in terms of its design? Have you dealt with an increase in folks using it?
We've had a somewhat of a caseload increase, about 4 or 5% over the past year. And that's the first sort of year-over-year increase we've had. So that certainly is the partly due to the economy, but I think largely due to the economy, I would say. But I don't think, and I'm very proud of the fact that we have not had what some people feared, which is an explosion in the rolls. And I think that is largely due to the fact that we did not relent in our continued and aggressive focus on moving people to work. And as I said, one of the great things about New York is this huge entry-level job market we have. Restaurants, tourism, call centers, health, education, all those areas are in abundance in the city, and they have provided a wealth of opportunities for people, many of which have continued to have openings during this economic downturn. And so that's allowed us to continue to place people in jobs. In 2008, which was during the national recession, we actually placed more people than in 2007. And in 2009, we were close to our 2008 levels, slightly down. But the point is, we still, even last year, placed over 75,000 people into jobs, and we've been able to do that again, I don't think by accident, but I think because the system is oriented around a strong employment focus.
As a follow-up, what benefits are available to those who happen to be on public assistance longer than the 60-month time limit for the Federal Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or TANF, benefit? And how do you coordinate with the New York State Safety Net program?
Well, New York, the structure in New York State is that the state is the oversight for the locally administered program. So the state provides some of the funding and writes some of the rules, but the actual day-to-day administration of all the programs is done at the in New York City at the city level and around the state at the county level. So we work closely with the state on interpretation of policy issues, regulatory issues, and some funding issues, but the actual administration of the program is done by the city. The federal assistance is provided for the first 60 months or so that somebody is on cash assistance. In New York, after that, they continue to receive benefits. There's no real change from the recipient's perspective. Some states have time limits or some change in benefits as you stay on for certain periods. New York does not have that. The major change, which is significant from a taxpayer point of view, though, is that you move from a benefit that has a significant federally funded portion, 50%, to one that has no federally funded portion. So the city and state shares go from 25% to 50%. So it's a significant increase in costs, especially in these difficult times. But from the recipient's perspective, there's no change.
New York City administers one of the largest food stamp programs in the country with more than a million, I think you might have said 1.6 million recipients. Will you tell us more about the food stamp program and the various initiatives you pursue to increase access to the food stamp program?
Yeah, food stamps is one of those areas that in the early days of welfare reform was often overlooked. To some extent, I think it was just because there was a focus, so much focus on welfare. And I don't think also people sort of realized how important it could be to low-wage working people. But food stamps, I think, is sort of a one of the benefits of being so successful with welfare, both in New York and around the country, is that it's had a renewed focus on the importance of food stamps as a food support. We've created so many working people that they now are ineligible for cash assistance, but food stamps is there to help them continue to sustain themselves and to give them some assistance, especially in those early days when they're working maybe at a lower wage. We've made a great effort in the past few years in New York to really increase the ability of people to apply in non-traditional ways for the food stamp program. Food stamps used to be like most government programs until recently, where you, if you wanted to apply, you had to go into an office, you had to wait a certain period of time, you had to see a worker, fill out an application by hand, and submit that to the worker, and wait and maybe come back and provide additional documents in a sort of a dusty, musty old office. And it wasn't very a pleasant experience for anybody. That was difficult. It was a deterrent because the sort of environment was not all that conducive to people wanting to come in to apply. Working people had to take significant time off from work in order to access the system. And the system was not set up in a customer-friendly way. So we've had a series of initiatives over the past several years to really both allow people to apply more easily, and then also once people have applied, the next point where a lot of people got tripped up and lost their benefits was at the what's called the recertification point, which is typically a year or so after they've begun receiving benefits. So we've made a lot of efforts to make that process easier. And the application process, we've done things like have enlist community-based organizations. Community-based organizations used to just pre-screen and tell people that they were eligible and then send them to our offices, which was fine. But now we've allowed them to complete applications and submit not just the applications, but all the supporting paperwork and send that to us electronically. And then we can do the interview by telephone. So somebody applying at a community-based organization now doesn't even have to make a trip for the interview to HRA's offices. They may have to come in briefly to be finger imaged. They will if they haven't been in the past, but they don't have to come in for the interview. We now have over 50 community-based organizations that take applications. So when you combine that with the 20 government offices, it just leads to many more opportunities for people to be able to go in, and that really helps. And we also do much more work by telephone, by mail. We have an integrated voice response system for people to be able to recertify in certain categories. So there's a number of options, all of which, when you add it together, I think show that the system provides much greater access, and we've had a huge increase in the roles in recent years.
Will you tell us more about HRA's Job Center's approach to human services delivery?
Sure. The Job Centers actually are a welfare reform era name. And before this, they used to be called Income Support Centers and Income Maintenance Centers, sort of reflecting the view of the program at the time. But with the greater focused on employment, there was a desire to send that message throughout the system. And one way we did that was to create job centers. And we did that as a name change, but it also had a programmatic and substantive change to it, which was that we incorporated some employment services into the offices that had not been there before. It used to be in the pre-welfare reform era that people would come in and apply for benefits and their eligibility would be determined, and that was pretty much their interaction with the offices. Now, when you come in and apply, you do have to go through an eligibility process, but you're also evaluated on that first day for participation in employment programs. You're referred, if we can do it, and you're eligible, to an employment vendor who is on site in the job center, and your support services in terms of childcare and transportation are set up right there. So it's trying to give a focus and a message both to the clients we serve and to our own staff that the primary reason we're there is employment and getting people into jobs.
And how has the Model Office Initiative sought to enhance customer service and streamline the workflow?
The Model Office Initiative, what we call our model offices, has really helped bring a greater customer focus and attention to issues. And it shows, I think, some of the sort of maximums of performance management, that if you don't measure something, you can't really manage it. In the traditional offices, people would come in and apply. If you go into a non-model office, people come in, they sort of look at a directory and find where they have to go, and they scramble for the elevator and get there, and there's no real organization. And couldn't really tell why people were coming in beyond the obvious that they were applying for benefits, but what particular needs they had, how long they had been waiting, how many people they had to see, and who served them. If there were there was a problem, it was hard to trace back often to who they had interacted with. So the model office is trying to address that, first to provide sort of a greater organization and structure to the office, which now people come in a more a format you see in most modern service organizations. They come in, they get a ticket, and they're directed to a particular area of the office that is the reason for them being there. There's a Qmatic kind of, it's not Qmatic by brand, but that kind of process there where numbers are called after they're at a particular area, and they are served. And that creates a better feel for the office. It's more organized. It creates a more professional image, which I think is very consistent with our emphasis on trying to present a more professional working environment, not a welfare office, but a job center. We also created a document drop-off and short-term customer service area because a lot of people, it used to be, and it still is in non-model offices, that everyone, whether they're there for something that takes 2 minutes or 2 hours, would have to wait to see a worker. And it created a problem for people who really could get in and out very quickly. The waiting rooms are much more crowded than necessary. So the customer service areas allow us to serve people who don't require an in-depth interview quickly, get them out of the building and back to whatever they need to do. And they reduces the this reduces sort of the tension in the offices because there are many fewer people. Behind the scenes of the model office initiative, because we're tracking people when they came in, why they were there, how long they waited, it's allowed us to manage now the whole issue of wait time and also monitor service time, whether people are being served too long or too short by workers. And we've used that information now to create standards for how long interviews should be, how long wait time should be. And we've seen, it hasn't been easy, but very steady progress in reducing wait times, and people are getting a better idea of how they have to reorient themselves to make sure that they serve people effectively.
Earlier you mentioned some of the barriers to employment that your clients face. Given your experience, what are some of the most prevalent and persistent barriers to employment facing those seeking assistance from your programs?
Well, one of the things that we learned, which I think was probably a surprise to people when you started welfare reform, is that the welfare population is not a homogeneous population. I think it's not, as some would believe, a group of people who are incapable of anything, who need years of rehabilitation to do work. And it's not, as others would say, just a group of people trying to scam the system who could get back to work and want the welfare check so they could have some extra cash. It's a range of populations, and some of it are people who just need a little bit of short-term assistance and can get back to work fairly quickly. Some of it are people who are unfortunately never going to be able to go to work because they have such serious mental health or physical health issues, and we need to help them get onto other federal benefits. And then in between, there's a range of people with needs. During the welfare reform period, I think the people who have the lightest needs, who need the services the least, are probably now a much smaller proportion of the population. Those were the ones, of course, who were most easily moved to work, who most quickly responded to the work message. And I think while we have some of them, especially in the downturn, we have some of them on the cash assistance caseload, as a proportion of the total, they're a much smaller group. But what it has done is brought into clearer focus the needs of the rest of the population. And we have a large component of the population with significant medical and mental health issues. We have a lot of people who have learning and literacy issues. And we have then a range of people with other kinds of social service needs, from domestic violence to substance abuse. And one of the challenges in a place like New York City, which is so large and where we have so many demands, is being able to quickly sort of assess somebody's needs and direct them to the program that is most appropriate for them, but having a range of programs that can meet the needs of people with all abilities.
Interestingly enough, with this sort of a diverse population and a diverse portfolio, how do you get the message out to folks? What are some of your outreach strategies? And more importantly, how does social media or Web 2.0 factor into those strategies?
Well, that is a very important part of what we do, getting the message out, not just to the clients and not just to our own staff, but the way HRA is structured, most of the actual services are provided by community-based or for-profit entities, but not contracted entities, not HRA directly, not government entities. And so you introduce another sort of level of complexity to the system, because those are people who, while that you may have a contract with them, you don't control them to the same extent that you would not that we control the government workers totally either, but you don't have the same level of influence and sort of input into what they're doing. One of the things that New York City has done very aggressively, which is help set the message on what we're doing, is to sort of let, to some extent, capitalism help the process. Our programs, our employment programs, generally are structured in a way that the vendors can only make money if they get people to go to work. We moved away from programs that pay just based on what we call a line item, you know, without regard to results, to ones that are in the total opposite direction. Our base central employment programs, there's almost no money paid to the vendors unless they move people into work and then sustain them in jobs. And so that very effectively, probably more effectively than I could do, gets the message to the people we're dealing with about the importance and ensures that we're on the same page. There's no dispute as to what they need to do, and they also feel this tremendous pressure that I was talking about before to keep getting people jobs, because if they don't, they're not going to be able to get the lights turned on or pay for the lights to be turned on anyway in the morning. So I think that's been very helpful. In terms of some of the media issue, the internet and other technology, we have made great use, I think, internally of the abilities that our intranet and our ability to quickly reach people. When I started at HRA in 1995, which was before the internet or the intranet were available, it was the only way really to communicate was to send a paper message out to people. And it wasn't, I don't think, as effective when you saw it posted on a bulletin board or something like that. Now, I could very easily reach people at their desks with messages. I can do it frequently. I can do it even in a personal way or to certain segments of the people that work for me. And I think that gives people a greater sense of personalization, a greater sense that it's directed to them as opposed to just something that's posted on the way to the men's or ladies' room. And I think that has helped. And I think it helps also internal communication. We can get out much more information about the agency, about the culture, about good things that are happening. And I think it helps make people feel like they're part of not just their little unit or their office, but part of a larger structure.
So how does HHS Connect fit into that portfolio?
HHS Connect is a project that we're working closely with. Primarily, it's been spearheaded by the Deputy Mayor for Health and Human Services. And it's an attempt, really for the first time, at least in New York City, to link the social services agencies in a way that is meaningful for the agencies and for the people we serve. And one of the things that people realize when you've been working in the system is that there's a lot of common clients for all the social services agencies. We were talking, joking once, about trying to serve people in some kind of public housing issue, and one of our people we work with said if all the caseworkers who were serving this person were here, they couldn't fit in this apartment that we were trying to talk about, because there are so many different agencies with people invested. But of course, they don't share information very well, and some of that is historical, it's confidentiality. It's a range of different computer systems. So HHS Connect is trying to break that down a little bit. And at its most basic level, what it could mean is that if you come in and you bring in your birth certificate when you're applying for public housing, you will not have to bring in that birth certificate again when you apply for public benefits. Now, again, there's work to be done. Again, there continues to be confidentiality and other kinds of issues. But that's really breaking down the information sharing barriers to bring the agencies together is really what HHS Connect is about.
What about doing more with less? We will ask Seth Diamond, Executive Deputy Commissioner of the New York City Family Independence Administration, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.